Ransomware cyber attacks are now a serious problem around the world. Here in New Zealand, 5 hospitals were disabled after an attack on Waikato DHB, and data apparently leaked after the ransom was not paid. But repairing, rebuilding an IT system after such an attack is a costly affair, and for many businesses, paying the ransom, well, could be more affordable. Ransomware attacks have shut down large sectors of the US economy in the last year or so, and ransomware negotiators are a growing industry. Cybersecurity company Group Sense offers this service. Bryce Webster Jacobson is Director of Intelligence Operations at Group Sense. He's in Washington, D.C. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Look, it's a pleasure. Is it any different negotiating with these people and negotiating with old-style kidnappers of people, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we hear that comparison regularly about negotiating for stolen data and negotiating for stolen people. And many of the insurance policies that were previously paying out cyber claims are actually from ransomware claims are actually from ransom people ransom insurance. Now, I've never personally negotiated for a hostage, the release of a hostage, so I can't make that comparison myself. But from what we hear, other experts who have negotiated for hostages or other types of negotiations, there are some similarities between conducting a negotiation with cyber criminals and conducting a negotiation with maybe groups that have kidnapped an executive from a company, per se.
I mean, in a way, the groups who do this kind of hacking could argue that it's a bloodless crime, a bloodless crime. Nobody's sending an ear back in the mail, are they?
That's correct. And we often see some similar language to that that you just alluded to, where these cyber criminal groups are saying that this is, you know, this is a business transaction. They don't view this as a crime. They view this as an operation to expose flaws in the organization's security posture, and that they are a recovery firm or a firm that is helping you identify a flaw in your network. And part of the payment that they're requesting is a payment for their services. The ransomware groups do often use language that's similar to saying that this is a victimless crime. Now, they do occasionally reach out, though, instead of, like you were saying, sending an ear through the mail as proof of life, they may call the employees of an affected organization, or they may call the customers, or they may call the media to try to incite or entice the victim back to the negotiating table and say, hey, we are really serious about this. We are, you know, to prove what we have, we're going to call the employees using the information that we've obtained from your systems and tell them about this incident. And that's a common threat and a common activity that we see from ransomware groups.
But nevertheless, they do think, you say, they're providing some kind of service showing how vulnerable systems are, and consequently deserve some kind of payment. There's an interesting kind of cognitive dissonance going on.
That's correct. Yes, it is. It's always fascinating to us when we see one of these ransomware groups or a very organized group of cyber criminals who don't view themselves as criminals. They view themselves as a business operation. They talk about their hierarchy within their organization. They talk about support. They talk about this as a business transaction. They don't view this as a crime. Now, some of the groups, they're under no false pretenses, right? They know they're criminals. They know this is a criminal activity. They know they've conducted an operation against an unwitting victim, an unwilling victim, and that they're extorting that victim for ransom. There are a number of groups that, you know, they don't pretend to be businesses, but there are a small number of these ransomware organizations that do, you know, talk about this as a business transaction, as a business function, and that they are helping the victim because they're exposing flaws in their security and they're helping to make sure the victim gets their data back. Nevertheless, never mind the fact that they were the ones that stole the data in the first place.
How many firms, companies, corporations have some kind of cyber attack insurance now, and how does that work?
That's a great question. It's difficult to get a sense of the total landscape of the number of organizations that are that do have cyber insurance policies. I would say it's an even split between the organizations that we work with, the companies that are hit by ransomware that call us for negotiation services. It's a pretty even split where about 50% have some sort of cyber insurance policy and 50% don't. The way that the cyber insurance works is it's similar to other insurance policies where the insurance firms are assessing the risk of the organization. They have certain minimum qualifications in terms of security standards that they're trying to enforce. You're paying a premium and there may be a deductible, but there's a payout if there's some sort of cyber incident, and they're assessing, the insurance companies are assessing the amount that they're paying out based on whether that be a ransom that's requested, the actual downtime to the downtime that an organization experiences while they're trying to recover their data, the incident response costs, where you were mentioning earlier, it can be kind of costly, extremely costly to repair and rebuild networks and systems to get you back online and to recover data. So all of those factors and all of those costs are taken into consideration when a cyber insurance policy is actually paying out if a victim organization is hit by a cyber crime.
So do you work for the insurance companies ever? Do the insurance companies call you and say, look, we've got a situation here. Would you negotiate and get the ransom down for us?
Yes, we work occasionally through the cyber insurance companies themselves, but the vast majority of the times it's the victims calling us, and then we work in tandem with their insurance company. But we do have a few insurance companies that we've built good relationships with that have approved list of vendors, including vendors for ransom negotiation, and our firm is on those lists. So we have had insurance companies refer our services out to their clients if they're hit by a ransom incident. But the vast majority of the time, it's the actual victim organization that's calling us up and notifying us of an incident and asking for our services.
Yeah, it's a strange kind of business, though, isn't it? I mean, how often... Do you find the hackers and are able to get the data or whatever it is back without the client paying the hackers anything? Does that happen?
It happens very rarely. We occasionally will see the majority of the time where we see a victim organization or a company that's been hit by ransomware be able to recover without paying a ransom is when they have robust backups that are offline and are not connected to the network that have been hit, and they're able to restore their operations from those backups. That's often where we see victims get away without paying the ransom, and because they have another option, they have another avenue. We always view the ransom payment as the last option, the last resort. If it's going to be helpful, or it's the only way that the organization is going to be able to recover from this incident. We do see some. Sorry, go ahead.
No, carry on.
Yeah, so we do see sometimes that the victims are able to recover from their backups or from other able to rebuild systems and recover data in other ways. I have one case where we had a victim organization who was able to recover their network or recover their data from the threat actors or the ransom group without paying, because the ransom group made a mistake accidentally sent over a decryption key that allowed them to decrypt their network at 95% of their network without actually paying for it.
So that would be like robbing a bank without a balaclava on.
Yeah, it was a very lucky mistake on our client's part that they were able to do that. But that's, again, exceedingly rare, and it was a mistake by the group.
It is estimated, figures vary, obviously, but something like $400 million in ransom payments were handed out to criminal groups last year, Would you think that figure is fairly right?
I think it's correct for the incidents that we know about. I know, specifically speaking about the United States here for a second, there's not really a central repository or a data clearinghouse or way for all of us to know how many companies and which companies were hit by ransomware and how much ransoms were paid or how much in ransom was paid. And that makes gathering data kind of tenuous in understanding the exact landscape of the situation. And that's just in the US. Much, even more difficult as you look around the world. So often we're left piecing together public reporting, news reporting. We're piecing together the data that's shared by ransomware negotiation firms or other cybersecurity firms that have interrupted these attacks, and trying to make sense of the total landscape based on the publicly available information. But I do think it's necessary that we have some sort of data clearinghouse or centralized reporting that can allow us to fully understand the scope of the issue, because the number that you threw out, about $400 million in ransom payment, sounds about correct for what we know. But I know there are cases that haven't been publicly reported, and I know there are cases that haven't been publicly disclosed by companies or reported in figures shared by cybersecurity executives. So I think the number is probably much higher.
Sure. I mean, bad for business to admit it. Bryce Webster Jacobson is a director of intelligence operations at GroupSense, and he's in the business of negotiating with ransomware cyber attackers. Where are most of the people that you've dealt with based, Bryce?
It's a good question. It can often be difficult to accurately attribute the locations to these threat actors, these cyber criminals. The vast majority that we have been able to get some sort of attribution, either through our work or other cybersecurity organizations that are work, a lot of them are based in Eastern Europe, in Russia, and in former Russian or former Soviet states. That's where the vast majority of them come from. We do see a few groups out of East Asia, Far East Asia, and occasionally out of the Middle East. But the vast majority of the criminal groups that we're negotiating against are in Russia or Eastern Europe.
Could the Russian government or other governments in Eastern Europe shut these gangs down if they wanted to?
I definitely think there's more that can be done by states that are harboring these criminals. You think about investigative bodies, law enforcement investigative bodies in many, many other countries have the ability to track down cyber criminals in their own countries. And we've seen successes across Europe, across Eastern Europe, across the United States, across New Zealand and Australia and all these other countries, where federal law enforcement agencies in those countries are able to track down cyber criminals because they're inevitably going to make mistakes and they're inevitably going to leave breadcrumbs that can lead you back to their trail. Unfortunately, for investigators like ourselves or cybersecurity firms like ourselves, those trail of breadcrumbs often end when we get to the countries that are harboring these individuals. So, yes, I do think there's more that the Russian government can do and other governments in Eastern Europe that have almost created a tacit acceptance of these individuals and of these groups.
Right. So it's become to some extent a political crime.
Yeah, there's certainly a political element to it, and I know that I'm thankful that ransomware and cybercrime has become such a focus of political and international conversations in recent months and years. And it seems like we, as a society, are starting to actually have a pretty firm understanding on the scale and the scope of these problems. In that the scope of these problems, the ransom problems and cybercrime, is much larger than really has been reported over the last 5 years. So I do think it has become a political issue, and I'm glad to see that there are governments that are willing to raise the issue of cybercrime and ransomware on the international stage among allies and take a coordinated stance against against these criminals and pressure governments that could be harboring these individuals.
Could it be argued that the very existence of you as a ransom negotiator is a kind of encouragement or at least a legitimization of the cyber attackers?
That's a very tough question. Yeah. You know, I would like to think that we are not emboldening any additional crimes. I think we, you know, for group sense, we would love if we could not have to do any more ransom negotiations. We our business existed before we negotiated ransoms. The vast majority of our business has nothing to do with ransomware. We've just had to spin up this service offering because we were getting asked by a number of clients that had suffered these incidents and needed assistance in navigating the not only the negotiation and how do you contact these criminal groups and try to reach a settlement that is manageable for the organization and isn't going to put them out of business, but also how do you navigate the acquisition of cryptocurrency? How do you actually make a transaction with these groups that you know, for a company that maybe has never purchased Bitcoin or Monero or some other cryptocurrency, and those are skills that we also have, and that we've been able to do. So, I would really love if we could not have to negotiate another ransom. I wish that was the case.
It's interesting you mentioned cryptocurrencies. I mean, how much of these kind of ransomware cyber attacks are directly due to the existence of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's hard to attribute the attack specifically to cryptocurrency, but it is important to understand and discuss the role that cryptocurrency does play in the overall ecosystem and landscape of ransomware.
I mean, it enables anonymity, right? That's the point.
Yes, correct. So it cryptocurrencies do at some level, and it depends on which cryptocurrency you're talking about specifically, but they do enable anonymity. Now, there are tools that allow us to investigate certain transactions with certain cryptocurrencies that remove some of that anonymity. There's also increasing pressure on brokers and crypto providers and wallet providers to enact stronger know your consumer KYC laws and more to increase greater transparency in the use of cryptocurrency. So that's something that part of the landscape is changing every day and every week, and it depends on the country that you're looking at. And so that's another part of what we have to do is stay on top of the updating, updating policies and regulations affecting cryptocurrency, and unfortunately, the ransom groups are also following that. Man. So, if there's one cryptocurrency that is becoming less anonymous, they're shifting to others. So, Bitcoin has been reporting on Bitcoin's anonymity and lack thereof in some cases. So some threat actor groups or ransom groups are shifting away from Bitcoin and moving to other more privacy-focused cryptocurrencies.
Can you tell me how much the last settlement was that you negotiated in dollar terms rather than Bitcoin terms?
Yeah, so I can discuss very generally. It was the original ask that we were. The victim was given by the ransom group was greater than $5 million. And we were able to settle at about 12% of the original ask. Now that figure is actually among the lowest that we've ever had in settlement. We typically are anywhere between 15% to 40 or 50% of the original ask. But the greater than $5 million ransom is not uncommon. We've seen higher than that. We've seen in the double digits, double digit millions of dollars, you know, tens of millions of dollars as an ask. So yeah, it's a different amount each time, and there's different factors that go into it. But
I saw one report that said that 92% of those who pay do not get their data back anyway. Can that be true?
I think that's an inflation of maybe some of the reality or a misrepresentation of some of the reality. So typically what happens is once an organization pays the ransom, they're provided a decryption key from the ransomware operators. And there are many, many times that decryption key works on the vast majority of your files, but it doesn't work on every file. And so in that case, you haven't recovered 100% of your data, but you've recovered 90% or 95% or 99%. Now, that could be argued that you have not recovered your data, and so you've paid a ransom, and there's a segment of your data that hasn't been recovered. But I think the 92% figure is a little overblown.
How do you feel about the authorities saying, as they would, do not pay the ransom, you're only encouraging criminals?
Yeah, I completely understand the perspective, and I think that is it's a very valuable and very understanding guidance that's provided by the authorities. Now, what I would like to see is additional or alternative mitigation opportunities or options for companies that have been hit by ransomware, provided by the authorities. So whether that's assistance in funding the recovery or assistance in funding the rebuilding of their systems or further or proactive education on security measures that the companies can take to prevent activities, but to simply tell an organization or a company that they're not allowed to pay, but they don't have any alternative options, is going to leave a lot of companies either out of business or forced to go further underground to try to hide the transaction from the authorities. So I think it's a fair response, but it needs to come with, there needs to be kind of alternative options that are presented and alternative resources that are presented to victims. Because until we deal with the problem of ransomware entirely and prevent it entirely, which is not feasible at this point. We're leaving a lot of organizations out to dry by giving them no alternatives.
One outfit that calls itself the Dark Side seems to have suggested that it's a Robin Hood kind of organization. It hacked the Colonial Pipeline, which was massively disruptive. But it has said that it won't attack schools and hospitals, and it donated $10,000 to two charities. I mean, what are we talking about here? Are they trying to depict themselves as a legitimate enemy of rapacious capitalism?
Yeah, I think it's all a part of the public relations campaigns of these of these ransom organizations. So when I was speaking earlier about the impression that they are businesses
public service,
public service. It's not uncommon to also see them operating like businesses in their other endeavors, corporate social responsibility. They're going to donate funds, $10,000 of the tens of millions of dollars that they've been able to acquire in laundered Bitcoin through these transactions. And we have to also consider that their holdings have appreciated in value if they've been conducting these transactions for a number of years. As the price of Bitcoin or the value of Bitcoin has increased, so have the holdings, so is the value of the holdings that these ransom groups have. So, you know, if they're donating $10,000 out of potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in Bitcoin, that's such a small percentage that it should only be viewed as a PR campaign. Mm-hmm. We've seen groups that have claimed to not attack hospitals and schools before, but many of these groups operate with affiliates, and they don't have control or visibility into where all the affiliates are deploying their ransomware or their malware. So we've seen groups that have said they're not going to attack hospitals and have attacked charities that that work with breast cancer patients, for example. And it's really hard to take their or to believe their word when they say one thing and go and still conduct attacks against similar organizations to what they claim they're not going to attack.
A couple of weeks ago, R Evil, which is the gang that has been blamed for the attack on the meat processor JBS in the United States, that I think paid $11 million out, the equivalent thereof, they disappeared from the internet. They just dropped offline. And there were many theories floating around about what had happened. What's yours?
Yeah, I think they took their money and they went home, and they will rebrand. Maybe they will turn into multiple different groups. They'll splinter off, but I think they'll be back. I think if there was any sort of government action by a Western government, for example, that would have been claimed at this point. We've seen little to no indication that there has been any claim by any government or any willingness to claim the takedown of the group by any government. So I think they simply cashed out, took all the money that they had and are focused on rebranding and reorganizing as potentially a few smaller groups, which is not uncommon for ransomware operators to, you know, exist for a few months or a year, 2 years, and then shut down and splinter off and start a new organization with some other criminals, and you resume your activities, you refine your activities. We often liken it to startups or small businesses, the serial startups, the serial entrepreneurs, where they have a new idea, they build it, they build that organization, they move on to the next project, they cash out, move on to the next project. I think that's what happened here.
Just give me some idea of, I mean, this is a kind of a personal question, of course, but how much you earn from one of those deals, right? You mentioned the case where the hackers asked for something like $5 million and you got it down to 12%. So how much of that would you take, or how does it work?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I'm glad you asked that, because I think it's an important distinction between how we operate and maybe how some other ransomware negotiators operate. We don't operate on commission. We don't operate on a percentage of the discount that we're able to get. We have a flat fee that's negotiated with the client before we even start our work. It's based on the number of hours that we're going to work, and we have an hourly rate for that. So if I was able to get that down to 8% of the original ask, that ransom that you were talking about, then that would have been great. But we don't want to incentivize ourselves based on the discount that we're able to get the victim, because ultimately we should be going for the biggest discount that we possibly can for that victim. We want to get it as low as possible to save them as much money as possible. So it's a very great question, because some organizations do bill their client based on the amount or the percentage of the amount that they're able to take off of the original ask. But that's not our business model. We think that creates further conditions for fraud and further conditions for taking advantage of the victims, and that's not what we want to do.
Excellent to talk to you. Thank you, Bryce Webster Jacobson, who is the Director of Intelligence for a cybersecurity firm, GroupSense, based in Virginia.